Graham Summers, President and Chief Market Strategist for Phoenix Capital Research. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with you, Tom. How are you today?
I'm excellent, Graham. And as I understand it, you've been spending a lot of time in D.C., doing a lot of work around critical minerals, around actual legislation around that stuff. And I'm sure we're going to get to that today. But I'd like to start by talking a little bit through the bond market moves and kind of how you see the outcomes of this. Of course, the announcement by Bessent 3 weeks ago was that they were moving from $2 billion to a floor of $4 billion per operation. And then on September 9th here, he announced that that was going up to $6 billion per operation, which happens every 1 to 2 weeks. So was this... is this kind of to help facilitate the massive debt rollover that needs to happen this year?
You know, that's an extraordinarily, that's a great question. So the way I look at this from a big picture perspective is sort of the defining secular theme for the last, say, 50 years has been that we were in this super cycle for bonds where for, from 1982 until about 2022, we had an overall downtrend in bonds globally. And it wasn't just the United States, although the United States is the most significant because treasuries, which are U.S. debt, as your listeners most likely know, those are the bedrock of our financial system. You know, when we went off the gold standard, there needed to be some fundamental kind of senior most asset that was owned by the banks that was used as collateral against their loan books and against their derivatives portfolios. And it's U.S. treasuries, primarily because the U.S. is the largest, most dynamic economy in the world. We have the most sophisticated advanced military. We're the superpower. We have the reserve currency of the world, et cetera. So the defining characteristic has been that we were in this long-term, bull market in bonds, which meant yields just kept going down, which meant that, we could issue more debt. And sort of the defining characteristic, I think, the thing that's a real sort of, I guess, what you could consider a tectonic shift, is that that bull market ended in 2022 when the Fed was forced to very aggressively raise rates. And again, this is pertaining to the Federal Reserve, but this was a global phenomenon. You know, globally, bonds generally, the yields went down starting in the early 80s. And the issue there was that, when we shut down the economy globally for COVID and then they pumped all the money into the financial system, the United States, I think we put in $11 trillion in a span of 20 months. Europe was very aggressive as well. Japan, everyone was aggressive. Inflation entered the financial system systematically. It wasn't just the kind of contained inflation where, 2% a year is acceptable. It was, 9, 10, 11% year over year changes in prices induced primarily by A, the supply chain being severed due to the shutdowns, which was kind of in and of itself problematic. We realized that the global economy isn't necessarily the best thing for some situations. And secondarily, all the money being funneled in. So, you've got less supply, more equal or more demand, and prices erupted. The problem with that was that central banks had to take action to stop this. And the way they did it was the way they usually do. They raised interest rates and the bonds reacted. And so if you look at like a long-term chart for treasuries, you'll see this long-term, downtrend. And then you get to about 2020, 2021, those yields suddenly spike. And since 2020, to 2023, they've sort of just consolidated. There's a lot of crisis talk and people in financial Twitter and on Substack and other places who say, there's this debt crisis coming. It's just around the corner. But we, nothing's really happened yet. We're in what you'd consider consolidation phase. And the yields, they're poking up. They're getting to levels that are problematic. But, we're not in any way resembling, say, Greece in 2011 or the pigs in 2012, where, things are actually like getting hairy. And that would bring me to a critical point I want to make to people, which is I remember I was talking to Ron Paul one time, and he told me about a conversation he had with Paul Volcker, where Volcker was explaining to him that, they're fine with things selling off or bad things happening as long as it's orderly. Mm-hmm. It's if it gets disorderly that it's concerning. So, it's not like anything happens and suddenly these guys panic. So all of that is a long-winded introduction to, Bessent has made it clear that he's concerned about what's going on with treasury yields and that he's at least aware of it. And we know that the Trump administration is aware are sensitive to these things from the tariff tantrum. If you wind the clocks back to 2025, when they introduced the, you know, Operation whatever it was, Liberation Day, and they had the stock market sort of melting down, they stomached that for a while. But it was only when the bonds really started reacting, and I think it was April 8th to April 9th, the overnight session, that the bonds really started to act what you'd consider disorderly. And that was what literally the next day Trump came out and said, we're doing a 90-day, you know, pause on tariffs, and everything calmed down. So we know just from prior activity that the Trump administration is, you know, they're, whether it's the president himself or those in his inner circle, including Bessent, they're sensitive to bonds. So the question is when Bessent announces this buyback and he increases it and he goes from 2 to 4, now 6, you know, is that really a huge red flag? Is that the Treasury really concerned about systemic implications? Is it more that he's just doing it for maybe political purposes and they want to just try and keep things kind of like calm until the midterms? That's really hard to see. What I see, and first and foremost, I want to emphasize to your listeners, people need to understand that bonds are an incredibly complicated thing. You know, you get a lot of commentators who just breezily say, you know, bonds this, gold that, you know, critical minerals this. And each of those subjects are ones that highly intelligent people spend their entire careers focusing on. And they'll tell you, I don't know everything. So I want to emphasize that when someone's just, you know, throwing this stuff out there, like there's this easy way to sew this stuff together into a nice little package, you know, should be a little bit wary. Having said that, the people I follow who are really sophisticated, you know, bond fund managers and traders, they've told me that, you know, it's concerning, but we're not in any way what you'd consider in a disorderly or messy situation. So it's hard to tell, really. I mean, the best thing I can think of is I think that when, you know, the issue they're running into is that the situation with Iran has obviously caused oil prices to go up dramatically. That's obviously dragging on longer than they'd like. And oil's an input for the entire economy. Some of the inflation data is starting to get pretty ugly. And, you know, the system can stomach volatility in energy prices for a period. But if you've got sustained, you know, like we're in now, it's whatever, 6 months, that starts to really start showing up in the data and starts to have knock-on effects. So I think a lot of eyes are going to be on the inflation data going forward. And I my feeling is what Bessent's doing is more of a verbal intervention or trying to send a signal to the world. But it's certainly by no means a bazooka. It's as anyone who can do basic math can tell you, you know, the Treasury market trades hundreds of billions, trillions a year, and, you know, $6 billion per bond auction is not, you know, a huge amount of money. I think more or less it's just, I suspect what they're trying to do is they find the Fed isn't necessarily going to be ready to do what they wanted to do fast enough. And so they're trying to sort of verbally intervene to keep things stable.
So I think, you know, the idea that this is a massive deal that mm-hmm. they're intervening with $6 billion is actually, you know, it sounds like a big number, but in the relative space of the bond market, it's not actually that.
No, it's my, well, they've been doing buybacks since 2021. It's not like this is even new, you know. It's mm-hmm. It's just that they're increasing the pace, and the bigger thing is the verbal intervention. You know, they're coming out and they're using these robust language. We're going to put a floor under the bonds, or we're going to make a market in long-term bonds. Like, that sounds really dramatic. Like, we're getting ready to make a really aggressive interaction. But, you know, as you're no doubt aware, I think the Fed was buying $40 billion of bonds a month just, you know, a few months ago. So $6 billion per auction, it's not, you know, it's in the ballpark of what's now considered normal. You know, if you wind back the clocks 20 years ago, this would sound insane. You know, the Fed only started doing large quantitative easing in 2008. But nowadays, I mean, quantitative easing to the tune of half a trillion a year is not even considered a lot anymore. So I think this is probably more trying to send a signal than actually taking action, if that makes sense.
Graham, what is the structure of how that debt is being changed, if at all? Is more of it moving to the short end of the curve, and what are the risks of that?
So all that's really happening here is that, you know, this is the thing, this isn't quantitative easing. You know, quantitative easing is the Fed prints completely new money and uses that to buy bonds. what the Treasury is doing is the Treasury is just entering the bond market like a bank or an investor, a hedge fund, anybody. It's just saying we're going to be actively participating in these auctions going forward to the tune of $6 billion, which tells you it's more about sending a signal than the actual activity. You know, if they were really going to get aggressive, it'd be a larger number. And you'd also see them trying to coordinate something with the Fed. You know, I think what's happened is when they put Kevin Warsh in the Fed, you know, Warsh has a big job ahead of him. He's trying to undo about 30 years of just terrible policy decision making, terrible pretty much anything from the Fed. I mean, he's got all these different task forces. I think he's got five task forces. Each one's related to whether it's economic data, how to actually manage Fed policy. Should it be interest rates? Should it focus more on the balance sheet? You know, are we going to focus more on liquidity as opposed to where rates are? You know, if you wind the clocks back, and hopefully none of your listeners have had to study the Fed as much as I have, but, you know, if you wind the clocks back to the 90s, before Greenspan really became, you know, the maestro, the Fed was this boring, like, hidden entity. You know, they didn't even announce what they did. The way you'd find out is you'd go to the, you know, bond trading in the New York Fed and you'd see where yields were. And that would tell you whether they'd raised or lowered. They wouldn't even come out and say, we're raising rates. They just did it. And they certainly wouldn't share anything they thought. And then gradually over time, you know, there was a little bit of a scandal. I think it was in, might've been 1998. And they decided, okay, we're going to start introducing the Fed minutes that we've, of things we've said in the past. And then after that, they said, okay, well, we're going to start introducing, actually announcing what we're doing. Then they said, okay, we're going to introduce announcing what we're doing and having a Q&A session. And you got this culture of celebrity at Fed officials. You know, you go back to the early 90s, no one could name any Fed official other than the Fed chair. You know, and now you've got, at least up until Warsh took the reins, I think it was like the Fed officials were like celebrities. You know, every chance they could, they'd get in front of a camera, start talking, and you'd get all this, you know, Daly in San Francisco says this, and this guy in Texas, Fisher in Texas says this, and like, how does this all interact? And like, they're just anything that offhand comments made just as an aside is taken as this massively insightful signal, as opposed to like an actual fundamental speech given by the Fed chair. I mean, and then you had Jerome Powell coming in and saying the Fed needs to be concerned about climate change. And so, I mean, it was just, you know, I'm not poo-pooing those policies. I'm not saying climate change is irrelevant. I'm saying like, it's ludicrous. The Fed's job is, you know, maximum employment and inflation. Climate change, it's like the Department of Justice. If they came out and, you know, the head justice came out and started saying, oh, we're concerned about interest rates. I mean, it's not in their purview. They're not supposed to be talking about it. So Warsh is trying to completely change this culture. And one of the first things he did was that first Fed statement they made, they cut out like 90% of the content. It was like two paragraphs down from a page and a half. He said, I'm not even, you know, I didn't even get engaged in the dot plot, which is another thing the Fed got into, was these projections where they just put these dots on this chart about where they think inflation is going to be. And everyone thinks that's, you know, I mean, if these guys were so amazing at predicting things, they wouldn't get it wrong so often. So it's, you know, the idea that their dots are even valid 2 years out is ludicrous. You've got people who manage, you know, tens of billions of dollars for hedge funds that can't even predict 6 months from now, who are much smarter than some academic economist, or at least more sophisticated in terms of reading the tea leaves on the economy. So rant aside, Warsh is trying to completely change that culture. And part of the problem of that is he's publicly acknowledged that a lot of the data in the U.S. is garbage. And that's pretty astonishing to hear from somebody in his position. People like myself and others have said for the longest time it's true, but to hear a guy actually say, you know, the response rates are like 10%, we're not even measuring the correct things. You know, the single biggest segment of the inflation data is shelter, but we don't even look at what the market rate shelter is. We ask homeowners what they think they could rent their home for, and that's the number we use to try and calculate what shelter is valued. I mean, it's just, you know, if they were physicians, you know, there'd be malpractice suits left and right. So he's trying to change all of this. But the problem with that is changing cultural inertia in an institution like the Fed, trying to change how they read things, how they measure things, and then how they communicate things. That's not going to be overnight. And so I suspect part of this is that I can't speak to this. I don't have some inside source or anything, but my intuition is that the Fed's really trying to change things around, but that means that they're going to be kind of handcuffed or sidelined a little bit as they sort it out. And so the Treasury is trying to step in and kind of be more active in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. As we're talking about yields, Graham, it mm-hmm. seems like yields all over, let's say, the Western world are climbing, mm-hmm. right? You have France, yes. Germany, Canada, the US, mm-hmm. all of these yields are at relative, let's say, 30 plus year highs.
Yeah.
Is that part, you know, concerning, or is that, you know, in some ways mostly based off of the US debt system?
Wow, that's a,
because of the value of the dollar.
Or is it based on AI? You know, are we seeing, you know, if the largest economy in the world, which is the US, the US is bigger than the second, third, and fourth largest economies combined. So that gives you an idea how, you know, people don't understand just what a superpower this country is. And I'm not saying that because I'm American and I, you know, I'm saying that, like, you know, if you just look in terms of math, our stock market's the biggest stock market. Our economy is bigger than the second, third, and fourth combined. I mean, it's the U.S. in terms of the financial system is so significant. It's impossible to downplay it or overstate it. You know, and the U.S. is running essentially a wartime economy playbook to a degree. You know, wartime economies, you have direct investment in sectors that are considered vital to national security. While we're doing that, you know, we're investing in critical minerals. We're taking stakes in drone companies. We're taking stakes in we even AI related companies. There's talk about implicit backstopping of AI providers. You know, you see something like Intel, where the president himself is personally pumping that stock. That's wartime economy. People think that's just grift. No, that's saying we're there's an issue that's so vital to national security that we're actually directly, we're going to steer the economy almost in a command style China type framework. Similarly, wartime economy entails, you know, aggressive running of large scale deficits, you know, just cranking up how much spending you're involved in. Well, a lot of that's going into this AI arms race with China. And if you believe what these guys are saying, I mean, Bessent's out saying that we cannot remotely slow down the pace of our AI build out. Otherwise, China wins. And if China wins, nothing else matters. If China wins the AI arms race, everything else is irrelevant. And you can hear that. And whether you like the president and his inner circle or not, you know, I can see the validity to that statement because, you know, you look at something like Google. We know for a fact that Google, based on the search results it produces, can shape people's views on things. In fact, there's some analysis that would argue that Google and the big techs actually were able to kind of sway the presidential election in the past, which is quite a thing to even say. I mean, 4 years ago, you say that, you sound like a conspiracy theorist. Well, it's, you know, there's the court statements now. We know that there's some validity to it. So if they can do that, well, if there's a technology like AI that's actually agentic in nature, meaning you don't even need to put something in, it can actually run itself and automatically do things. Well, my God, you can consider the effect that would have on the way people think, the way people choose to spend time, the way they do things. And if China ends up controlling that technology and being the world leader in it, well, that is certainly a cause for concern from a national security perspective, regardless of whether you're pro-China or not. You know, if you're running the United States and your adversary is potentially going to win this arms race for a technology that's going to probably unlock the future of who's the next superpower, that's a pretty important thing to consider. So, you know, a concern I have, or a thought I have sometimes, is the bond market doing all of this just because there's this, you know, the two biggest economies in the world are engaged in this massive technological arms race that involves, you know, so much of the supply chain and strategic change, whether it's critical minerals, production, you know, you've got exploration, development, processing, refining, then you've got purposing, you know, manufacturing, integrating, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got everything from, you know, baseline technology where people are talking to LLMs to like more sophisticated, what the military would consider exquisite technology, where you have these, you know, we get a taste of it every now and then, like when the United States captured Maduro. You know, let's leave our political perspectives to the side and just look at this as a human being who's trying to assess a technological situation. You read some of the testimonies by the Venezuelan security force, and they're like, these soldiers descend from the helicopter and this force hits us, and it's like your head's exploding and people are vomiting blood. blood's coming out of their eyes and their ears. They can't even move. And these Delta Force guys managed to go through hundreds and hundreds of security forces from Venezuela and get Maduro from, you know, Maduro's wife tells him, I hear helicopters. They run to the escape room and the Delta Force guys get them before they're there. And then they're out of the country within 40 minutes. I mean, technologically speaking, you're talking about us having the capability of literally shutting down the infrastructure grid, power, water, everything for a major city, entering its airspace, which means we completely negated their radar capabilities and all of their, you know, whatever readings they have of anything from thermal to radar. Then you've got the capability of getting guys airdropped in from helicopters who can then go through hundreds of security force personnel. And they admitted they just slaughtered them. It was like 40 guys killed like 400 in the span of like 5 minutes. And then they can get the leader out of his bed and back in a helicopter and out of the airspace in 40 minutes. So, you know, the technological capabilities of some of the stuff they're building with these things, and you can get hints of it. Anthropic comes out afterwards and they're like, we're not happy that our technology was involved in some of this stuff. I mean, you get a sense of what's going on behind the scenes. You know, this is really what, again, the military calls exquisite levels of technology. That's highly critical stuff to national security. Now, regardless of whether you agree with what we did with Maduro or not, I'm not trying to say, oh, this is amazing, look how great we are. I'm saying we revealed some things that we're capable of doing that are pretty mind-boggling. And that's probably not even the whole, you know, deck of hand, the whole hand we've got from the deck, so to speak. So the key thing I'm thinking about is just how much is this AI arms race of impacting bonds? You know, how much of this is actually inflation and costs are rising, because obviously they are. And how much of it is just that, you know, the two largest economies in the world are throwing everything they've got at developing stuff, some of which we're not even capable of imagining right now. And I don't really have an answer to that. You know, there are people who've probably spent their whole lifetime in national security studying this stuff who wouldn't even be able to give you a clear cut answer on that. Mm-hmm.
Well, to your point about the idea of a wartime economy, I believe the debt just crossed over 100% of GDP for the first time since World War II. So is that concerning to you, or is maybe a better way to look at it of thinking, let's say conceptualizing it versus the stock market? You know, the stock market is 2.4 times the size of public debt, or 1.9 times the size of the gross federal debt. So is that of concern, or are we looking at it wrong versus GDP?
This is the thing I love about your podcast, Tom, because you actually ask nuanced, contextualized, relative questions, because it's all relative. You know, I weigh 200. This isn't true, but, you know, if a guy weighs 200 pounds, but he's got 10% body fat, is that guy in shape versus the guy who weighs 160 pounds, who's got 40% body fat? You know, it's these things are nuanced, complicated things that we need to consider. You know, when I was younger, when I was first starting out, I called the Great Financial Crisis in 2008. I thought I was pretty hot stuff at the time. I was one of only, and I didn't just call it. I had clients in cash. We were shorting the banks and things. Like I did some things that put my name on the map. And I thought I was pretty hot stuff. Like, oh, I figured this all out. You know, debt's a big problem and this, that, and the other. But that kind of thinking can really blind you, and you can get carried away with your own kind of confirmation bias. And I see that a lot in podcasts where people say, oh, we've reached the point of no return, or there's no buyers left, or whatever it is. Obviously, there's buyers. We haven't had a failed, auction. We haven't even come close. So these are really complicated, sophisticated questions. And the big issue, I think of, Stanley Druckenmiller comes to mind. He's, arguably the greatest money manager of the last 50 years. I think he averaged 30% for 30 years, every year for 30 years. And he said that he always was concerned about the debt, but he had a critical, point in his framework, which was he never let the level debt levels or any of that stuff affect how he invested. You know, unless he actually had a clear signal from the bond market that there was a problem, he never let any of that stuff that we all doom about, he never let that impact what he actually did. And the point I'm trying to make to answer your question is I don't have a good answer for you. I would have thought, psychologically, 40 trillion seems like a lot. 100% of GDP sounds like a lot. But, and you could certainly make the case that there are countries like, Greece, they had, I think it was 120% of GDP, and they got into a debt crisis. But there's key differentials. You know, they couldn't print euros and buy them. They couldn't do their own quantitative easing. They had to use the European Central Bank to do that. You know, we can. And then you look at the other direction, you look at Japan. Japan's got debt to GDP of, I think, 200%. They've basically nationalized their financial system. The Bank of Japan's the largest shareholder of Japanese stocks in the world. You know, they're like a top 10 shareholder of like half the stock index. They own over half the debt. There's days in which certain durations don't even trade. And somehow their financial system keeps existing. And, you know, their bond yields are going up a lot too. And a lot of people would have said, oh, you know, it's lights out. And yet somehow the lights are still on. So I can't answer your question. I would have thought it would be a bigger concern by now, but things continue to chug along. I think what I would suggest, because I know you like your listeners to learn something, is I would suggest looking at high yield credit, you know, junk bonds. Those are kind of like the canary in the coal mine for the debt markets, because those are bonds that they have a pretty good chance of default even under the best circumstances. So the people that trade those things tend to be A, much more sophisticated in terms of measuring macro risks, because, you know, the reality is if anything goes wrong, they lose everything. And second of all, they're just much more attentive and attuned to what's going on. So I watch junk bonds quite a lot, because I just think if something's going to go wrong, it'll show up there first. And in fact, a lot of times they tend to lead stocks. So they're also a useful predictor for that. If you overlay, you know, HYG, the iStocks high yield debt or high yield credit ETF to the S&P 500, they're actually pretty closely tied. And a lot of times you'll find credit bottoms like a day before the S&P or it tops. You know, it's a useful tool to have. So, you know, if I could tell you, hey, Tom, November 4th, you know, we're going to default, I probably wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be, you know, taking out a second mortgage, third mortgage, leveraging up, you know, just getting ready for that. And that's a big problem for me when I see commentators saying things with such certainty. You have no idea. You know, the best thing you can do is look at the probabilities. And so far, there's no real signs of any major hiccups anywhere. You know, there's definitely, again, we could come back to Bessent, you know, $6 billion in buybacks every auction seems like a lot. But, you know, during COVID, we were spending, what was it, $50 billion a month alone on QE. We expanded the balance sheet of the Fed by $3 trillion in like 8 months. Like, you know, inflation came, but we somehow got through that. So I don't know. I wish I had a better answer for you.
Fair. Graham, you know, as we talk about that COVID era and we consider the amount of liquidity that was put into the system, adding to all of that right now is Trump's new announcement again for $5,000 for everyone if the Republican can keep the House.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
So
it's a wild time we're living in, isn't it? It just comes out at the convention and throws that. All, it's almost like an offhanded remark.
Well, I mean,
and that's after the Trump accounts, which is they're investing kids' money in stocks now. So yeah, it's pretty wild. I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
But I was gonna say that adds something like another $1.2 trillion. Like, where does that money come from?
You know, we live in such a strange time. I remember in 2008, you know, there was a lot of talk of quantitative easing is going to ignite inflation and China's going to dump our debt and they're the largest holder of debt. And if they do that, we're screwed. It's game over. Well, fast forward to now, almost 20 years later, China holds, you know, I think they're not even the top two or three debt holders anymore. The Fed holds more than anybody. And, you know, you say that to anybody, especially an Austrian economist, and I do tend to lean that direction. They would have been like, oh my God, that's just, you know, that's like Weimar, you know, you're buying your own debt and debasing the currency, like hyperinflation, it's game over. We did it. And, you know, I mean, I'm not mocking the financial system because I'm fully aware that inflation still is a real problem. I mean, you go and spend money on anything, it's outrageous, the cost of things. And there's this big debate on Twitter about burritos. I'm sure you saw the other, you know, $20 burritos and what does that signal about the world? But the reality is that we're just in, it's hard to say what's normal and what's not anymore. And that's a big problem in a lot of ways. You know, you take anything from inflation to immigration to what have you, like the data changes what it means, you know, again, I'm not saying I support this, so please don't take it that way. But if, you know, the US deports whatever, 2 million people, well, obviously the workforce shrinks. And that has a profound impact on the jobs data and on other things. Does that mean we're in a recession? Or does that, like, what exactly does that mean? Inflation is whatever it actually is, because it depends on what you believe in the data. You know, is inflation 2%? Is it 3%? Did the Fed give up on 2% a couple years ago and just didn't tell anybody? Inflation's critical to measuring GDP because that's how they deflate growth. You know, and it's what makes macro so complicated. You know, we saw this with the SOM rule for a while there. Everybody was talking about, oh, well, you know, the SOM rule is this way of measuring how unemployment's measured, which has signaled recession. Let me rephrase that. There's all these data points, whether it's a yield curve inversion, the SOM rule, what have you, that have predicted recessions, whatever, 8 times since 1955. And they all happen and we didn't have a recession. It's problematic because macro is very fluid. You know, a job in 1950 is not a job now. In fact, I think Goldman Sachs put out a piece and said something like 60% of jobs that are in the current economy didn't even exist in the 50s. So the thing is, this is all very fluid. It's a very complicated thing to try to make sense of. And I will say this, the Trump administration has proven itself strangely capable of things that I think most rational person would not have thought would pan out the way they did. I remember when we first started the war in Iran, I saw a lot of big name guys coming out and saying, you know, if the Strait of Hormuz closes, global depression, you know, inflation goes to 10, you know, all this like really bombastic stuff, none of which happened. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the end of the US petrodollar, all of this stuff. But yet here we are 6 months later, oil's over 100 and stocks are close to all time highs. We hear that corporate profits are growing at like 50% year over year, something crazy like that. Their earnings per share. You've got us adding a trillion, you know, we're adding a trillion in debt every 100 days. The Treasury's now actively involved. The Fed's talking about me. I mean, it's, you know, all of this stuff. If you'd said it 6 months ago, someone would have said, okay, guaranteed, you know, recession, guaranteed stocks crash. And none of that happened. So it's bizarre. That's one of the strangest things about analyzing what the President Trump and his crew of guys do is, like, again, I'm not trying to speak of them in admiration, but there's almost like a bulldozer component where they just plow through whatever it is that people are concerned about. And somehow it kind of works. It's bizarre. You know, there's people who are highly intelligent, highly, you know, strategic, clever people who have major concerns about some of this stuff. And yet, you know, nothing's really, you know, obviously there's been loss of life and horrible things. I'm not making light of that. But like from an economic perspective, other than where oil's trading, you'd have absolutely no indication anywhere that anything was wrong from most of the data they come out with, which, again, we don't even know how good the data is. So it's a strange, strange thing. I wish I could, again, I wish I could give you a better answer. I spend a lot of time. I know, again, your listeners try to learn. I think a critical thing if you're trying to become a competent person, especially for things like investing and financial knowledge, is you need to quickly be able to discard stuff that's useless. And mm-hmm. something that's been absolutely vital to me, both as a trader personally and for my clients, is that a lot of, like, anything, whether it's even one of my strongest held opinions, if it proves to be useless or have no predictive value or it's not panning out, I'm more than happy to abandon it, and I'll make myself. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I look like a jerk because they're, you know, once or twice a year, I have to tell my clients, look, I was dead wrong on this, mm-hmm. you know, but the reality is you're playing probabilities and you're doing the best you can. And it's the greatest puzzle in the world. It's a puzzle where the piece changes its nature. It, you know, you're playing chess and each chess piece changes not only what it can actually do, but its relationship to the other pieces all the time. And anybody who can tell you, oh, well, I knew all of this in advance, you know, you're lucky if you get a nice streak here or there, but you got to be willing to admit, like, I'm dead wrong on some of this stuff. And I'm wrong all the time. You know, the main thing is I'm right more than I'm wrong, and my clients make more money and lose less when I'm wrong and because of risk management. And as a result, I've been quite successful. So, you know, that's the way you need to look at this is. Does this have any predictive value? Because you see all these accounts on Twitter and everywhere. Oh my God, this hasn't happened. This is what? Yeah. Did it predict anything? Like, did it actually translate to anything of any value? And second of all, does it actually translate to what you're trying to accomplish? You know, if your goal is to sound smart, knock yourself out. If your goal is to make money and you want to invest well, then you have to be very willing to say, okay, you know, this doesn't work. Bye. This is useless. Bye. Like, this guy's dead wrong about, okay, I don't care how smart he is. I'm not listening to him anymore. That kind of stuff. And you end up kind of being a little bit cold at times. And also you have to be willing to be humble because, you know, I've been in this game 20 years and I've made a name for myself, but like just, my God, just in July, I was having to eat a lot of egg in front of clients. And like, I was wrong about this. And, you know, we just have to, we then found out that some of the things we're invested in were that Leopold kid's fund blowing up and him getting liquidated, which I had nothing to do with. And, you know, you couldn't have foreseen, but you know, you have to say, okay, I'm dead wrong. We're out. Doesn't matter. We're out. And we're going to look at the next thing now. Mm-hmm.
Well, Graham, from a, you know, we've talked about inflation kind of peripherally mm-hmm. here.
Yeah.
You mentioned the idea that oil is back up over $100 today.
Yes.
Obviously diesel is at all time highs as well. And that ties directly into, especially the US economy, considering that a lot of the world and this country runs on diesel.
Yes.
What types of policy, you know, levers can be pulled in order to affect the inflation picture here going forward?
Well, one thing we've kind of learned is oil's pretty easy to move around. I'm sure you've noticed, as have many others, that, you know, the number of times oil's just cratered based on some statement from the president is pretty shocking. Again, that's a great example. You know, if you'd said oil prices at certain things, you know, it's this big problem and, you know, oil's going to 100, 200, 300, whatever it is. And then you've got the president coming out and saying, oh, we got a deal just around the corner. We'll be fine. And oil drops like 5% that day in the futures market and everything reacts. That's kind of shocking. You know, that's power. That's been one of the big wake up calls, I think, for a lot of macro guys this year, is just how easy it is for Trump to manipulate oil, whether or not it's even true or not. The other thing is we have no idea what the real state of the oil market is. I remember when we first went into Iran, there was this argument, well, they closed the Strait of Hormuz. That's kind of a misleading thing to say, because did they actually close? You know, they didn't put up some barricade. What they did was they threatened to blow anything up. And the insurance company said to the tankers, we're not going to insure you if you try this. And so the tankers didn't move. So was it closed? You know, my point was, it was a complicated situation. Then we find out that actually a whole lot of tankers were going through that they claimed weren't. Then we find out that, I think, what was it? They just announced they'd been digging this trench and they were trying to find a secondary route through the Strait of Hormuz. And then we find out Navy SEALs were like underwater getting rid of mines, but also a lot of the mines were just inflated trash bags to look like mines. I mean, my point is, this is like this. I remember when it first happened, I said to my clients, I did some just basic analysis. You know, this is one of the most complicated geopolitical messes we've ever been in. You've got a country that's 20% of global oil and liquid natural gas goes through the Strait of Hormuz. They're surrounded by, I think, 5 countries on land, 8 if you count bodies of water. You know, their own ethnicity is only 50% Persian. The rest are these different groups. It's actually a very young country, a lot of powers. And you know, my point was, it's, you know, it's complicated as hell. And you have all these people saying these blanket statements. And so it's hard to really get a read on anything. The only thing I can say with any certainty is it's pretty obvious Trump can manipulate oil pretty easily. Secondarily, so there's that. You know, you've got a president who likes to talk, happy to talk anytime he wants, and the market keeps falling for it because we're on whatever, round 38 of a deal being just around the corner at this point. And the market keeps falling for it. So it works, and he's going to keep doing that till it doesn't. You know, obviously, our domestic production levels are different than they were historically. The U.S. is allegedly energy independent. Then they signed this deal with Venezuela. I don't know. I would have thought inflation would be just raging by now. And I mean, prices are certainly ridiculous, but it's nothing like it was during COVID, where, you know, just, or during, not COVID, but 2021, 2022. Like if you read the Beige Book, you know, the Fed has this thing called the Beige Book, the eight branches that Fed put out. They go and talk to captains of industry and people actually on the front lines of the economy and ask them what their concerns are. They talk about concerns about prices and things going up, but it's nothing like it was during the inflationary sort of storm we had in 2021, 2022. Back then, if you go and read the Beige Book, it was like every respondent's concerned about prices, like every respondent saying they got to hike prices, and it's not happening. So I don't know. I wish. I'm sorry. I feel like a lot of times you're asking me great questions, and I'm saying I don't know, but I really don't. I had base assumptions going into this mess, and some of them proved correct, and some proved incorrect. And I will say that my framework currently is that their view is, let's just get through the midterms. That means we need stocks up. That means we need some kind of economic bump to try and the people who are getting hurt by higher cost of living, we need to somehow throw them a bone. So that's these, Trump accounts or $5,000, whatever it is he's talking about. And then you've got like Treasury verbal intervention and like trying to like just let's just keep bonds calm for now. Like let's just we got 60 days. Let's just keep this thing under wraps. That's kind of what I think everything's focused on. And they're even willing to admit it implicitly with the president saying, the war is on hold till after the midterms. It's like, well, that's quite a thing to say. So, it's a bizarre. I tell you, it, being a strategist under this administration is it's certainly never dull. Let's put it that way. But the
Well,
main
we're
thing
gonna.
I'd say is, sorry, the main thing I'd just say is you got to look at the trends, and the trends are so far, stocks are in a bull market, bonds are behaving for the better part, and oil's a wild card, but they've proven they can slam that if they want to. The question is it finally getting to the point that they can't? And I don't know yet. We'll have to wait and see.
Well, Graham, we're going to move into the bonus section for subscribers. Of course, that's
Sure.
available on Substack here. We're going to go over Trump's moves to kind of try to declare gold a critical mineral. So, please join us for that.